Hello and welcome to Sean White's Solar and Energy Storage Podcast. Today we have a very special guest. His name is Richard Lawrence, and he's kind of famous in the solar industry. A lot of you might have known him from when he was the executive director of NABCEP. That's when he was the guy in charge. I can remember meeting Richard Lawrence before that when he was also working at NABCEP, and I was on the PVIP exam committee. He gave me a ride to like this one place to another place. I think we were going to the NABCEP offices, and so I got to talk with him there, and I was fortunate to get to know Richard a little bit there too. And he's done some other stuff that we're going to ask him about. Right now, he's doing something very important for the Interstate Renewable Energy Council. That's IREC. He's a program director. We're going to talk a lot about that. He also had a couple of years working for IBTS. We're going to ask him what that stands for. And he also has experience with the Solar PV Instructor Training Network. And I remember that. And he was working with Hudson Valley Community College. So, hey, Richard, thanks so much for talking to us here today.
Hey, Sean, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I was also remembering too, I saw you, it was in 2019 at the SPI, I believe they still called it SPI instead of RE Plus there. I went down some stairs and you like threw a ball or a frisbee to me or something like that. So that was just like some fun times.
Yeah, we've certainly seen each other around lots of events over the years.
Yeah, all over the place. And so let's see, before we dive into it, tell me a little bit about IBTS. You worked there for a couple of years.
Yeah, IBTS, Institute for Building Technology and Safety. They do a lot of different activities, but it's a nonprofit organization and headed up their energy division. And what they're most well known for in the renewable energy space is they're the largest third-party inspection firm that operates in renewable energy and energy efficiency technologies. So we had contracts with some state agencies like NYSERDA and the Massachusetts Clean Energy Center, but also did a lot of work for private companies, basically inspecting their installer networks to monitor the quality of the installations and, you know, but for some finance providers who wanted to check and make sure that what they're paying for was being installed properly. So I've inspected lots of systems and had a lot of data on issues that the industry has with that. And, you know, lots of problems there still, but certainly all tied into other positions you mentioned there. Sort of my background and focus has been around that education and training and with the focus of that quality assurance side of things, making sure that the industry is doing things right so that we continue to operate well, have good customer satisfaction, and avoid some of the black eyes that bad practices will certainly bring to everybody across the board. So what we've been working on is consumer protections and quality assurance through education, training, workforce development, personnel certifications, quality assurance, inspection services, all of those types of things.
Yeah, thanks for doing all these great things for the whole entire industry. And speaking of third-party inspections, I remember doing a couple of those for, it was over 10 years ago, for Burnham Energy, and they're not around anymore, but it was a lot of fun. I remember I was staying in Maui doing a class there, and then a couple of different days, I think it was two different days, I jumped on a little commuter plane, went from island to island, which is just a quick little hop, rented a van, went to like the big box store, picked up a ladder, and then climbed on a bunch of roofs. And I remember seeing the worst ever install that I ever could imagine. And these things were already approved by the AHJ. And I remember there was solar thermal literally overlapping PV. Like it was some kind of new multi-junction technology, I guess.
Right. There's all kinds of problems out there.
Yeah, that was quite a while ago. But I guess that just goes to show you why they do third-party inspections. And so they were doing inspections for somebody else that was financing the project, and they wanted to see how it's going to operate, not just if it was installed up to code. They wanted to make it so they would get their money back and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's pretty great. And so right now you are working for IREC, and I believe like your main thing that you're dealing with right now is the apprenticeship programs?
Yeah, that's correct. So I am a senior program director here at IREC, and our workforce team came over. We merged with the Solar Foundation. That's who I've been working
with. Yeah, I remember the Solar Foundation.
Yeah, a couple of years ago, our organizations merged. And so a good team from Solar Foundation came over, and bolstered the IREC staff here, very complimentary programs that we have across workforce development. And at the time I had been hired on at Solar Foundation to work on the Solar Ready Veterans Network, which is a Department of Energy project that actually does have its roots back into the Solar Training Network project that you mentioned. So I'd been aware of it for quite a while, started off as a pilot, I believe back in like 2015 with the Solar Energy International and working with Department of Energy under the Solar Training Network. But they had gone through a couple of iterations. Solar Foundation had won the award to continue on that work. It's evolved into a couple of different areas.
I think they had something like the Solar Jobs Census or report, something like that.
Yeah.
Is that still happening?
Yep. Yeah. I've been doing the Solar Jobs Census for, I think, since 2010. So
yeah, I remember they flew me out to DC one time and they had a bunch of people and we were all helping them come up with what they were doing. It's been a while.
Yeah, that is definitely one of the reports that Solar Foundation and now IREC has taken that over, and we continue to do that work, but that we're most well known for. Certainly get a lot of press and visibility around that report every year, looking at the jobs in the industry. So yeah, we were working on the Solar Ready Veterans, which is obviously the project to get more veterans into the solar industry. That has evolved over the years, like I said, from that initial pilot, where it was really focused on installer training. And now we've broadened out to really look at all different occupations across the industry. You know, veterans bring a lot of different skill sets from different areas and can plug into lots of different jobs. And so we've got a couple of different programs there that are connecting across the whole spectrum. And that's another resource that IREC is known for, is our career maps and other tools that we have to help job seekers understand the industry and the types of jobs and then the training that we need, the certifications that might be available in that. So we've got a lot of resources on there to help any job seeker to understand the options across the industry, from manufacturing is certainly growing to clearly construction and the installation of projects is a big thing, but across into finance and policy and legal aspects, some of those professional services and engineering, there's jobs all across the board, and veterans bring a wide range of talent to those positions. So we've been working on that, and that has led us into the apprenticeship. That's how we got involved first into apprenticeship.
Yeah, IREC does so many things. It's hard for me to tell people what IREC does. And I know that you're doing the apprenticeship, but maybe what we can do too is to just kind of explain what the Interstate Renewable Energy Council is. And I know that right now it's run by Larry Sherwood, who's an awesome guy. And I did just see somewhere that I think he's retiring.
Yeah, that is recently announced. So IREC has been around a little over 40 years. We are a national nonprofit and tend to operate at kind of that fairly high level, although we do dig into the local initiatives. We do a lot in Puerto Rico when we run the Soul Smart program. So we help local communities implement permitting reforms, train their inspectors, and take other actions locally to change their zoning laws, things like that.
IREC just does a whole lot of everything. Like, one of my claims to fame is I am an IREC master trainer. I was the 2014 trainer of the year. That's 10 years ago now. I got that award in Las Vegas. I remember when I got the award, I was trying to pretend like I was Elvis and I was like, thank you very much. But I don't think anybody got the joke. I should have worn the Elvis glasses. Are you guys still doing the award ceremony?
You know, I don't know that we've done that award in a little while, but it's certainly we should bring back up if we haven't.
Yeah, because I mean, it was just like cake, you know, you got to get an excuse to eat cake and also just rub shoulders with a lot of smart people that are doing really good things. And so it's a nonprofit. And some of these nonprofits, a lot of people even think they're just government organizations. Is a lot of the funding government?
Yeah, I'd say certainly a good portion of our funding is from government contracts and awards and cooperative agreements. We do certainly use donations for a variety of things. We are not a membership organization, so we don't have that due structure like some of the other organizations do. We are independent in that way, but yeah, most of our projects are funded either through government awards or through philanthropic organizations.
Are you also an IREC trainer? I think I remembered that you were like one.
You know, I did never get certified as an IREC trainer. Early in my career, I was doing more training. I started up a college program at Cobb Community College and was teaching solar courses and wind and other sort of survey of renewable energies. So I certainly did a fair amount of teaching myself, but then got into the more the program administration. So did not qualify that credential.
Yeah, I remember applying for it and keeping it is quite a process. So they want to have lots of documentation and things like that. So IREC is serious.
Yeah, our accreditation program is set up under the ANSI standards for how do you run those programs. So it's certainly managed according to the best practices for running personnel and accreditation services. We accredit training programs, and that's, goes back to our commitment to quality and high quality standards across the industry. And that's where our program accreditation and instructor certifications come from.
Great. Another thing too that IREC does is they have a web page or something where you can go on there and figure out the licensing requirements for all the different states and non-states, because a lot of people live in a place where it's not a state, like Washington, D.C. or Puerto Rico. And you can go in there and see what it takes to do business, to be a solar contractor, things like that. So that's very helpful. I'm always telling people about that.
Yeah, one of our most visited pages actually is our solar licensing database. And I'm actually leading a project right now through the SEAC working group to update that. So we're going state by state and trying to make sure that's all up to date. And we'll have a new version out of that later this year.
So let's tell people what that acronym means is SEAC is Sustainable Energy Action Committee.
Correct. So the Sustainable Energy Action Committee started in Southern California years ago as just some local code officials and industry representatives working to get together and share their perspectives and try to come to common ground between industry and the code enforcement and really work on some issues that were challenging to both parties.
So they came up with a committee like that. I guess it was probably a bad surf report that.
Yeah. Well, things have been active in California for a long time, and lots of industry practices come out of there to start or have historically. So this group worked together for a long time, did a lot of convening of the parties to really work through some issues. And IREC took that over a few years ago. We got some Department of Energy contract to help expand that and broaden it beyond California. So we've taken that into a national, bringing together code officials and inspectors and others on that quality assurance side with the industry and again trying to move forward best practices for all of that. There's a number of working groups that meet regularly on different issues, looking at the upcoming code requirements or code cycles and making recommendations for updating the codes and other standards that are out there, and then bringing of all these issues. And yeah, we've got a personnel, there's one that's focused on personnel qualifications. So looking at resources around that and helping people understand what it takes to be a qualified and competent worker in the industry.
So SEAC, Sustainable Energy Action Committee, and then that would be sustainableenergyaction.org. How's that related to IREC? I know you can be on the committee without being IREC, or is IREC running it now?
Yeah, IREC's been running, managing the SEAC group. So, like I said, just took it
Oh, great.
nationally.
Yeah, it's very helpful. Like I go on there quite often and look at different reports that you have. Like I've been doing some energy storage stuff lately, and it's a great resource. So thanks for doing that.
Yeah, another one we've got there is Empowered has a lot of resources for energy storage and emerging industries there. One of the things that Solar Foundation and IREC have done is looked at the related occupations around the industry. We've been talking about like code officials, the building inspectors and realtors and firefighters and building operators and other entities like that are involved in the industry. We call them allied professionals that really can have an impact one way or another, making things easier or making things more challenging if they don't understand it. So we've done a lot of work to create resources for those people that are adjacent to the industry in these allied professions. So lots of resources on the website on irecusa.org. You can get to our resources page, and we're always putting out a lot of stuff. And one area we didn't mention that throw into we're known for is a lot of our regulatory work. So we do have a whole team that works in the regulatory space dealing with interconnection and net metering and other policies like that, where they would intervene in those cases. And we've got, model best practices there for interconnection procedures that we try to get out and get adopted. We know that's a major issue facing the industry now, and we're trying to help streamline that and improve those processes as well.
Yeah, and just another thing too is I remember the previous person that ran IREC was Jane Weissman. So shout out to her. She retired also. All these retiring people, I'm never going to retire. That's not for me. I got to keep myself entertained by doing all this really fun stuff like saving the planet and things like that. That's what I like to do.
We'll be sad to see Larry Sherwood leave. He's certainly given us a fair amount of time to do a good search and then to onboard that new person. But yeah, Larry's been around for a long, long time, was executive director at the American Solar Energy Society, ACES, was also executive director at NESE back in the day, which is the Northeast Sustainable Energy Association.
Not just another Loch Ness monster, yeah.
Right. He's worked also at the Small Wind Certification Council. So I've interacted with Larry for many years in those various capacities.
Yeah, I remember he was also running the show when we were doing, they called it the Solar PV Industry Forum, where we were coming up with the National Electrical Code and we were meeting at NREL, and he was the guy in charge.
Yeah, the Solar ABCs, I think, is what that project made.
Yeah, I think they changed the name of it different times. Yeah, I think it was Solar ABCs at the time. And I know Sia is running it right now. So if anybody out there wants to write the NEC and put their own words into it, there's a committee for that. There's lots of committees. You can be full-time on committees, and I think some people are. You might be too, but you get paid for it. It's your job.
Yeah, well, yes, the ones that I help manage. Yeah, we are always looking for volunteers to help. It is very important to get the industry perspective. And I'd say more and more, we're seeing these grants, especially from the government, that are requiring that industry participation. Volunteer effort that industry players provide can count as cost share in a lot of the projects that we do. So it helps us get those awards and to do the important work that we do. We always want to make sure that it is aligned with the industry perspectives. So we always want to get that input, and we've got a variety of ways to get involved. I mentioned that Solar Ready Veterans Network. We've got an advisory committee for that. We've got some other working groups that are looking at new apprenticeship templates, new guideline standards, they're called. And we've got, like I said, working on updating that licensing database. So, you know, giving us input and how does licensing work in your state, and that SEAC working groups. There's a number of ways to get involved there in those, the code adoption updates, like you said. Looking at model language and making those proposals. So we're helping to coordinate some of that. So lots of ways to get involved. If anybody's listening here, wants to support these efforts, we'd love your support.
Great. And so speaking of the veterans, I just actually had a real Army general on the podcast. We released it on April 21st, and his name is John Kim, and he's with the American Battery Factory. So maybe you could get him some extra benefits, huh? So that's one of the things you're doing, is the Solar Ready Vets Network. And also the main topic that we were going to talk about today was going to be apprenticeships. And I know that you know more about this than just about anybody as far as what's going on. And so I thought maybe what we could do is to talk a little bit about this, and the Inflation Reduction Act has apprenticeship requirements. So like maybe we could start with the basics of what does that mean, apprenticeship? A lot of people know there's apprentice electricians. I mean, I guess 1,000 years ago there was apprentice blacksmiths.
Yes.
So maybe we can explain it. Like, it probably doesn't mean following your father around, learning his trade, but it could be.
It could be if you're working for a family-owned business, for sure. But yeah, we did get into apprenticeships, like I said, through the Solar Ready Veterans Network. When we looked at ways to get veterans into different jobs, apprenticeships came up as one of the top recommendations from a lot of people we talked to, because veterans are not very well known, even among veterans in apprenticeship programs, to be honest. When we think of the GI Bill, we typically think of paying for college expenses, but a veteran can also use the GI Bill for this other higher education pathway of apprenticeships, and they can get a housing allowance. Their military housing allowance is then paid directly to the veteran if they're in that registered program. And so it's a great way to register apprenticeships, or a great way to attract veterans. That's what's got us, again, into this. And
so is this just for veterans, or is it?
No, for sure. But that is one of the key benefits to having a registered apprenticeship program for employers. It does help them attract veterans and other diverse populations. So step back, what is an apprenticeship? So apprenticeship is a way to learn an occupation, learn of a job that typically learned through on the job, learning by doing and under the experience of a trained mentor, somebody who knows what they're doing there. So the fundamentals is it's primarily a trade on the job with the experience of a mentor showing you the ropes. Apprenticeships have to combine also some related instruction. So you are taking some classes to supplement what you're learning in the field. You're taking those theory classes.
So how does that work too? Like if somebody sets up an apprenticeship program, I know that the unions are doing that, but is there certain rules? Can I just set up an apprenticeship program tomorrow? I don't think it's that simple for just like a little small installer maybe to go like, I'm going to start an apprenticeship program.
Yep, it is definitely possible. There's lots of misunderstandings about apprenticeships. And first is that they're only in the construction trades. And the second is that they're only with unions that you mentioned. At least, you know, that certainly is where there is a lot of apprenticeships and historically in the United States. But apprenticeships are really just that training model and they can be implemented. There's a really wide variety of options for how do you implement apprenticeship programs. You have to have an employer that hires that apprentice and provides that training with their staff. And then you have to have related instruction. But that instruction, those classes the apprentice would be taking, if it's with the union, they're going to be at the union hall. But if the apprenticeship could be done in partnership with a community college, you might take classes there, or it could even be all taught in-house. There are certainly some examples of that. One of the first apprenticeship programs outside the unions that we're aware of in the solar industry was done by Revision Energy. So they're a regional installer up in the Northeast.
Yeah, they take my heat spring classes.
Yeah. So they did start up their own training center. They provide the training in-house using some electrical curriculum and some other classes, some manufacturers training and such. But they deliver that classroom training in-house in their facilities with their own instructors and are able to train electricians through their apprenticeships up in the Northeast. In a couple of the states they work in, you have to be an electrician to work on these systems. And so they're like, well, I guess we got to figure out how to do that. So it's certainly possible for a smaller company to do that, to manage a program. We certainly encourage participation with partners like a community college that can deliver that classroom training.
Yeah. So for the heat spring classes, I think that they're doing that. And I just make the curriculum for the classes. So that's not my side of the business. But does that sound right? When you were saying revision, it made me kind of think that maybe they're working together on that.
I don't know that they're working together. I think most of those classes are taught in-house at Revision, but I know that Brian there at HeatSpring has been looking at apprenticeships. I can't speak for them and what they're doing, so I'll leave it at that.
I'll have to bring Brian on here next. Yep.
Yeah, you can have an apprenticeship program and then just bring in classes like that. The classes that HeatSpring does, many of those can be incorporated into apprenticeship program. Really, the heart of apprenticeship program is it's employer-driven that says these are the occupations that we need. We're having trouble finding people with these skills, so we need to develop them in-house. And they set up the training programs around what their needs are to train their employees. Now, a key part of an apprenticeship is that it does align that occupation across an industry. So if you're going through an electrician program in Florida or California or wherever, you're going to have somewhat similar curriculum content that needs to be taught, the things that need to be learned on the job. One of the key things with an apprenticeship is that it standardizes, or at least tries to get an industry together around a common understanding of what the training requirements are for that job role.
We have Brian Hayden here from HeatSpring because there were a couple of things that I wasn't too sure about as far as HeatSpring and apprenticeship programs go. So, hey, Brian.
Hey, Sean.
Yeah, Brian is the founder of HeatSpring, and he understands everything about HeatSpring and how that works with apprenticeship programs. So can you tell us a little bit more, Brian?
Sure. So when the Inflation Reduction Act came out and there was the requirement for registered apprenticeship programs and anything bigger than a megawatt, we had to figure out pretty quickly how we wanted to help our customers comply. And where we netted out is we've got a whole bunch of free good information on our site about how to comply. There's free courses, toolkits, and we're always here if people want to reach out and get a little bit of, you know, just a human interaction about how other companies are complying. So you can always kind of reach out to us in that way. But then really the meat of what we're providing is the related training instruction. So all these apprenticeship programs need 144 hours per year of RTI. And so we're a provider of that.
What is RTI?
Related training instruction. It's essentially the classroom training that you need as an apprentice.
So my classes are being used for this then?
That's right.
Cool. All right.
So, you know, we're a provider of the RTI completely for some companies. And we can provide examples of that if your company is trying to put together a program. And then in other cases, just, you know, we're a part of the overall program. Like maybe they have internal trainers who teach some classes. Maybe there's a class at the local community college that they really like, but then they kind of supplement with some of our classes. And yeah, Sean, your classes are a part of that for a lot of companies.
So please put us into the mix, people. And how would people get a hold of you to find out more or sign up, things like that?
Yeah, there's a registered apprenticeship program section on our website, heatspring.com. Also, we're not a huge organization, so pretty much any contact information you find on our site, you're going to get somebody who knows what they're talking about, or you're one step away from somebody who knows what they're talking about. So info@heatspring.com, fill out a form on our website, call 800-393-2044 and hit extension 0. If you're looking for us, you'll find us.
Great. So you hear that, people? Get your apprenticeship requirements met and get NABCEP certified. Check it out. Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
Yeah, so I'm at the HeatSpring website, and they do have an apprenticeship page, and it says HeatSpring helps solar companies comply with new industry apprenticeship requirements. So now we kind of know what apprenticeships are. And then also for the Inflation Reduction Act, there's apprenticeship requirements. You probably know all about those, I imagine.
Yeah, as much as anybody can at this point. Yeah, let me step back. So we kind of broadly talked about apprenticeships, but at the heart of it, again, it's that employer-driven. They need to train somebody in that job. There's a common understanding what it takes to train somebody in that job. A registered apprenticeship is one that is registered with either the federal government or a state apprenticeship agency. Roughly half the states operate their own apprenticeship system at the state level, and then the other half operate under the Federal Office of Apprenticeships. And when you register the program, that then has certain guidelines that have to be followed, regulations that have to be followed. So it gives a little more structure to how the apprenticeship systems works and makes sure, again, that it's kind of standardized across the industry nationwide, or at least at that state level if it's a state agency.
So do you see, is there like registered and unregistered apprenticeship programs?
Absolutely, yeah. And similar to certifications. So you can certify some, anybody can start up a training class and say, hey, you're certified, right?
Can we just certify people for listening to this podcast? Like every person listening out there, you are hereby certified. Sean White, Solar and Energy Storage Podcast Certified. How's that sound?
There. Exactly. But the real certifications that are managed according to the ANSI standards, like NABCEP, they have to follow those rules and regulations and guidelines of how do you do things correctly. So that's similar to a registered apprenticeship program. Anybody can run an apprenticeship program with a little A. Again, it's that on-the-job learning. Everybody kind of does that anyways. You got to learn on the job, right? What this does, when you register it, now you've got some regulations and you're following the standards and such that are set there. That adds some additional administrative burden and things like that to managing the programs, but it also gives it a lot more credibility. And that worker then, when they graduate from that program, will get a credential in many ways very similar to a college degree that says they've completed that apprenticeship that's recognized by the Department of Labor, and they can then use that credential to show their work qualifications, their knowledge and experience.
Great. So you mentioned the Department of Labor. Is that one of the organizations you would register an apprenticeship program with? And what would be examples of other organizations?
Yeah, if you want to have a registered apprenticeship program, and this gets back to the Inflation Reduction Act requirements. So the IRA is the first piece of legislation I'm aware of that's tied these tax credits to actual labor standards, labor provisions. So the labor standards under the IRA, almost all of the tax credits that are in there, there's a wide variety of them. Most of them reference these labor provisions that say that you have to pay the workers a prevailing wage. This is typically for the construction phase of a project. And generally, it's the larger projects, 1 megawatt and up. All of the construction workers have to be paid a prevailing wage in order to get the full value of those tax credits. So it's a prevailing wage and apprenticeships. 15% of the labor hours for that construction do need to be performed by a registered apprentice. And so that apprenticeship training program is going to be registered with either a state agency, depending on the state where you're operating. Again, about half the states operate the apprenticeship system at that local level of the state. Other half operate directly through the Office of Apprenticeships, which is in the Department of Labor.
We interrupt you for a very important announcement. Sean White's Solar and Energy Storage Podcast has been brought to you by Sean White's Solar and Energy Storage Podcast. That's right, Sean White is sponsoring his own podcast. and he wants to remind you to go check out some of his classes. You can go to SolarSean, that's Solar, SEAN.com, and then click on the links to check out his classes. You can check out his heat spring classes, and you can also hire him to teach classes for you, like at your company, something like that. Now back to the show. So just like you have the licensing database, what kind of license it takes to become a solar installer or energy storage installer, does IREC also have a database of apprenticeship programs that are registered?
We leave that primarily up to the Department of Labor right now. They are the ones that are registering those, so they have a directory that would...
Oh, so the Department of Labor has that. And yeah. Then that would be for all the state programs?
Each state would have their own program as well there, but they do monitor. Most of those feed up to the Department of Labor, so you'd see them listed there too.
Okay, so like if I was in a particular state and I wanted to install greater than a megawatt and get the full 30% tax credit, then I would have to go through the apprenticeship process, and I could hire somebody that already has it going on, maybe like a union or something like that. But also I could start my own program and just register it with the state or the federal government. And so I could just Google, like, say, Louisiana apprenticeship program or something like that.
Yeah, there are options to comply. There's different ways to run the apprenticeship programs. There's certainly all the union halls out there. And I know you do some work with the carpenters. That is one occupation that certainly can be trained and does get involved with solar installations and wind installations too, I might add. They also have that millwright occupation, which goes back to the old wooden windmill days, is why it's a carpenter. But nowadays it's working on wind turbines and other things like that.
And of course, there's the IBEW, the all-powerful International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. And then the Carpenters Union that I'm involved with is the United Brotherhood of Carpenters, the UBC.
Correct. Yeah. And then on the larger installations, there's a couple of agreements that are out there. One is between the electricians, IBEW there, and the operating engineers and the laborers. That's a three-party agreement that separates out the work between those different trades. And so you can apprentice in any one of those occupations. So you can become an apprentice laborer or an apprentice electrician or an apprentice operating engineer, which runs the equipment on a job site like that. And you would work doing that work for that company and get that job experience, and then also have to take classes in those related fields. Right now, solar installer is not an occupation that is recognized as one that you can train in an apprenticeship program. I should say outside of Florida is the only state that actually recognized solar installer. So Florida does have a solar installer contractor's license, so they recognize it as a trade in that state. Great. There are only a handful of states that do that.
Yeah, California does have a solar contractor's license.
California does, but California has not recognized it as an occupation. Even though they've had a license for over 40 years for that occupation, they refuse to recognize it as one that you can train as an apprenticeship.
Right. And I have one of those licenses, and I just feel so bad right now.
As of this week, it's not a very useful license. They just took away the ability of the solar contractor to install batteries, well, at least greater than 80 kilowatt hours.
I know. I just saw that you posted that, I think, on LinkedIn. And so I have the C46 license. Fortunately, I have the electrical license too, the C10. So that's a get around. But solar always used to be batteries. And then now the politics is taking it away. It's like good old politics.
Yeah, as long as that license has been around, solar installers have been able to install batteries associated with that equipment, and it has been unlimited of scale there in terms of the size of the system. And as you say, 20, 30 years ago, even 15 years ago, you'd be hard pressed to find a solar electric system that didn't have batteries in it, right?
Yeah, I almost wonder if it has something to do with when the National Electrical Code kind of took energy storage out of Article 690, photovoltaic systems, and put it into Article 706, energy storage systems. It was a new article, and maybe that kind of messed it up for my C46 license.
Well, that was one of the points that was brought up by those trying to restrict C46's ability to work on that. They did state that it was a separate code article, but I don't find much validity in that because they also have to refer to all kinds of other articles when they're installing conduit and the conductor sizing and other, you know, your disconnect rules are also found in different sections of the code.
Yeah, we know what it really has to do with who's making the campaign contributions. It's the larger organizations. Maybe we just leave it at that. But, so for prevailing wage, how did they determine that? I was just talking to somebody that designs like utility scale solar systems, and he was telling me that it's costing them $200,000 a year for an electrician. And I know that would include the profits that the person that hires the electrician, so it's not going all to that electrician's pocket. But what does that really mean, prevailing wage? I think it's different for different places. I know there's right to work states, which pretty much means non-union states, where maybe it's different because of that. I know that if you're in an area like San Francisco, it's probably going to be different than if you're in an area where the wages are a lot lower and the cost of living is lower.
Yeah, correct. And I will not claim to be a prevailing wage expert, but certainly know a little bit about it in relation to the IRA guidelines here.
Is there a prevailing wage for IREC program directors?
No, there's not. We've not done a wage survey for that position yet.
Well, I'm not going to encourage you to go on strike, so.
So the prevailing wages are set essentially at the county level, and they're done so through the Department of Labor conducts what's called a wage survey for a particular occupation. And so they will survey the employers who have people that do that job role, and they will say, all right, what are your wages you pay? What are your benefits as well? A prevailing wage, it's not just the pay, it's a combined wages and benefits scale. And they come up with what is the common baseline wage for that county. And when you're doing, Inflation Reduction Acts or other prevailing wage projects, you really have to look county by county as to what the pay rates are for that class of worker. So then you would look at the type of work that they're doing, determines what then that class of worker would be. So even if you haven't called that person an electrician, you haven't hired them as an electrician, if they are doing work on a job where they're touching electrical wires and things like that, and doing conduit and other electrical work, then they would be classified as an electrician for the prevailing wage. Same for operating engineers. If they're driving equipment and that's what they're doing that day, well, that day they're the operating engineer and you have to pay them that wage rate. So it's county by county. You go in the system and you look it up. If you can't find the appropriate wage classification, they haven't done it either in that county, or the type of worker that you're using isn't recognized there yet, there is a method for requesting a wage rate through the Department of Labor. And they can, you can follow the rules there. But yeah, basically those are set by, again, surveying a number of employers and finding kind of that average wage that a worker's paid for that type of work.
I also know that there's some, let's say, controversies or disagreements over what an electrician is required to do. And so you have people putting piles into the ground, and then you have people putting together the rails, trenching, things like that. And then there's the putting down of the modules without connecting them together, and then putting the modules down and clamping them on and connecting them together. And I think it's just different in different places. But I've just seen some of that controversy going on. And of course, everybody wants it to be their thing, you know?
Yeah, and that kind of gets down to the state by state and the apprenticeship system, but really the states determine the regulations, laws, et cetera, around who can do what type of work in that state. So typically, licensing is done at that state level, and that gets into, again, what are the requirements to perform certain types of work in those areas. So we do see variation state by state. Again, our solar licensing database helps with some of that, where some states will say, hey, in this state, we consider every component to be an electrical component, and you have to be an electrician to touch it. And in other areas, they've been able to separate some of those job roles out. Again, example is this three-party agreement with the trades, because even the trades themselves are kind of battling back and forth as to who does what type of work.
Yeah, I've kind of seen some of that firsthand.
And so that agreement kind of tried to help divvy it out and say, okay, here, laborers can do up to this type of task, and then the electricians need to do this task, and the operating engineers can do this task. There is another agreement as well that involves more 15 trades. It's a very broad agreement that covers kind of all construction type technologies, and that works for solar as well. And that the
15 trades. Wow.
Yeah, well, in that sort of broad, being able to construct any type of facility, not just renewable energy here, any type of building or
Do you have
industrial.
an example of that? Is it like a particular organization that's doing that?
It's an agreement that's among these union trades, and that is one, you know, again, the carpenters are involved in that agreement. So that is a way that they can carve out their role on the project.
That's a lot of trades there.
They're not necessarily all going to be on that project. It just says you may not have gas fitters involved, but they are part of that agreement that says, all right, if you have this type of work, then they would be in it. But a solar project wouldn't have that type of work. So
great. So if somebody wanted to be involved, install over a megawatt, where would you recommend they go? Because they would need to meet these prevailing wage and apprenticeship requirements. So what would you recommend to people that are trying to do that? Like maybe somebody that has like a smaller company, I guess, you know, the bigger companies, they obviously already know, but maybe they don't, but maybe you know more than these small companies.
Yeah. So I would certainly refer to our website, irecusa.org. And on there, we have the program, the Apprenticeships in Clean Energy Network, ACE Network, is a Department of Labor funded. We're actually a contractor to the Department of Labor.
ACE Network.
Yeah, the ACE Network. So we have a contract with Department of Labor. We're what's called an industry intermediary. And our industry is the clean energy industry. So the Department of Labor has hired us to be that liaison between the industry and them, the Department of Labor, to help the industry understand the apprenticeship system and navigate that system. We do also even have some financial incentives that we can help people to hire apprentices from diverse backgrounds and train them in these occupations, and really broad across the spectrum. Lots of demand being driven by the Inflation Reduction Act for those construction occupations. And one other thing I forgot to mention. So the Inflation Reduction Act says prevailing wage and then this 1 megawatt and above. But the other piece is that any contractor working on that project who has 4 or more employees working on that project has to have at least one apprentice. So really every contractor that's engaged, not just the 15% of the total labor hours, it's any contractor that has at least 4 people working on that job, at least one of them has to be an apprentice. So it's really across the board, anybody involved in the construction of those projects and across the board in terms of any of those clean energy, could be carbon sequestration or could be, you know, wind or other facilities like that too, battery storage facilities. I mean, the electric vehicle charging infrastructure funds, those are all tied into these same requirements. So we've got resources on our website. We've got funding to help as well. So encourage everybody to come. We've got free technical assistance that we can provide. We're paid for by the Department of Labor to help you understand the system.
Great. Yeah. And so I was just looking up the ACE Network. So it is on the IREC website and it stands for Apprenticeships and Clean Energy. Because I was kind of, when you said ACE, I was thinking of gambling, things like that, especially since, you know, I got to get ready for the next NABCEP conference, which is going to be next March in Reno. So Reno's famous for gambling, lots of ACEs up there. And then there's Ace Frehley. I don't know if you remember Ace Frehley. Kiss, the band Kiss.
Yes, of course.
Yeah, so great. And so another thing too that people are worried about, and I'm sure nobody really has the answer for this, but maybe I just thought I would bring it up. There's an election going on. And do you think that the results of the election could reverse some of these tax credits, the ITC, the apprenticeship requirements? Or we just leave that up to somebody else to answer.
Yeah, I certainly won't comment on the politics of it. Yeah. But from what I've read, most people seem to think that even though there's very strong difference of opinions on both sides of the aisle around particularly the Inflation Reduction Act and the green initiatives, and the Inflation Reduction Act is literally the largest bill, government agency action anywhere in the world to fight climate change. And so you know, those who don't believe in climate change don't think that we should be spending this investment to become more sustainable energy sources, more domestic energy sources through these. But anyways, it is funding a lot of investments in manufacturing, which has been a big push, certainly both across the aisle on both sides, that everybody wants to see more manufacturing. So we've certainly see lots of examples of people who did not vote for this legislation, but are at the ribbon cutting ceremonies and promoting the jobs that are being developed in their locality. So the majority of the investments are actually going into red states. And from what I've read, most pundits and such that I've heard on ask this similar question, they're not too concerned that this will be eliminated. While it's certainly on the priority list of the party that's not in the present seat right now, Yeah, most people think it will be a very difficult thing for them to actually do when it involves saying they don't want these jobs in their communities then.
Yeah, and even if somebody doesn't even believe in climate change, I kind of think that there's just a lot of stuff here that's just good for everybody. Like you were saying, manufacturing, things like being self-sufficient in energy, like making more energy and all that stuff. So there are just lots of jobs and things like that. Things that would be hard to just tell people, like, oh, you're going to lose your job now because we don't believe in that. And another thing, too, is I think with politics and things like that, that probably a lot less changes than the rhetoric would have you believe.
Yeah.
But yeah, let's not get anybody upset. I know there's even in the solar industry, there's a lot of people that vote for both sides. So yeah, so what do you think, Richard? You want to talk about some more stuff here?
I do have another meeting I'm going to have to hop off on at the top of the hour here. So would love to chat more. We can go on and on about these topics, I'm sure. But it was a pleasure joining you today, Sean, and look forward to seeing you at the next conference.
Yeah, for sure. So thanks so much, Richard Lawrence of IREC, Interstate Renewable Energy Council. Thanks for being on Sean White's Solar and Energy Storage Podcast. To find out more about solar and storage and apprenticeship programs and all kinds of neat stuff, go to solarsean.com. And one more thing, we're releasing a special podcast celebrating the 80th birthday party of Hermann Scheer, a solar saint who brought us the modern solar industry with a German feed-in tariff, that's the FIT law, and an interview with another solar saint, Eike Weber, who ran the Fraunhofer Institute for Solar Energy Systems for 10 years. That's the European equivalent of NREL, the National Renewable Energy Labs. Among other great things that he did, Eike was a friend of Hermann Scheer, and also my claim to fame is I'm a friend of Eike's too. And by the way, Hermann Scheer is no longer with us, but we are celebrating his birthday party anyway. Happy birthday! Woohoo!